The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning. How are you?
Boker tov, Tu B'Shvat Sameach.
Thank you, you too.
A happy day, yeah. I mean, Tu B'Shvat, unfortunately, we can't celebrate in the usual way. But I just wonder how many people know that there is this historical disagreement over when the date for Tu B'Shvat really is, the typical Hillel versus Shammai disagreement, where the school of Hillel has decided that today, the 15th of Shvat, should be the day for Tu B'Shvat, whereas according to Shammai, the first day of Shvat should be Tu B'Shvat. And of course, because it's a new year of sorts, it's one of the four new years that are mentioned in the Mishnah. One would have thought that a new year would have come on the day of a new month, but apparently not. The other three, by the way, do fall on the first day of a month, but not this one. But lots and lots of tradition that surrounds Tu B'Shvat. It's not only what some people regard as a kind of an Arbor Day type of celebration in Israel, where people go out and plant trees, which of course they do, and it became a very big day for celebration within the kibbutz agricultural community. But also there are quite strong Kabbalistic kind of traditions that surround Tu B'Shvat, including this Tu B'Shvat Seder that was apparently implemented around the 16th century by one of the great Kabbalistic rabbis. And the tradition is that you have you sit down and you have a meal, which includes four cups of wine and also 10 particular fruits that are chosen for Tu B'Shvat, that are specific to Tu B'Shvat. And they ought to be eaten in a certain order with a particular brachot attached to each one. And even some people keep the etrog from Sukkot and pickle it over the time between Sukkot and Tu B'Shvat.
Gosh,
and they will eat it today on Tu B'Shvat. So, you know, there's a link between Sukkot and Tu B'Shvat, lots and lots of different things surrounding the festival of Tu B'Shvat. Unfortunately, as I've said, because of the current pandemic, we're unable to celebrate all of them. But still a nice day. Eat some nuts, eat some fruit. Let's celebrate Tu B'Shvat. Of course, you know, the new year for fruit has some significance within halakha, because there are certain rules surrounding when you're entitled to eat fruit and what type of tithes are associated with each fruit. And the years are counted from Tu B'Shvat according to how old the particular fruit tree is and whether or not you may eat the fruit. But interestingly, the Shemitah is calculated not from Tu B'Shvat, and because it's an agricultural link, I would have thought that maybe it should have been counted from Tu B'Shvat, but no, Shemitah year is actually calculated from Rosh Hashanah. If there's somebody out there who can explain that to me, I'd be delighted to hear more.
Absolutely unbelievably interesting that we're still kind of trying to figure this out, even though there is some clarity. There is some a lot of sources for all of these things. Prime Minister Netanyahu has shed a little bit more light on the strategy that lies behind the recent lockdown and the vaccination program while addressing the Davos conference. What new information has come to light?
Well, I think that, you know, what the Prime Minister mentioned in his address to the Davos World Economic Forum, which of course usually happens in Davos in Switzerland around this time of year, where you get these pictures of world leaders and economic leaders swanning around in the snow-filled streets of Davos around this time of year, which is usually a very, very scenic. And of course, this year it's all being done online. And Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke by video to the conference, to the forum. And he mentioned a few things which I think were interesting. And it's a shame that he didn't talk about these things more openly with the Israeli public directly, rather than for us to have to hear about it via his address to the Davos conference. That's my view. But anyway, I mean, obviously it's come out in the press, so we know what he said. And what he said is that the lockdown that we're going through right now, closing of the airports and closing of the land borders and attempt to try to hermetically seal Israel, is because there is a fear that some of these new variants, some of the new mutations that are arising, may well be resistant to the vaccinations that we are receiving at the moment. And so that's why there is this concern. So Whereas I thought that once more people became vaccinated, we might be inclined to open things up a little bit, at least from the borders perspective. It seems like it might be exactly the opposite, where we're afraid that our huge effort to vaccinate people will somehow go to waste because of the fact that some of these new variants that are arising from all over the place now may well be resistant, or at least until such time as we know that the vaccinations that we're receiving will be able to cope with these new variants. So that was the one thing that I thought was interesting. The other thing mm-hmm. that he mentioned was that he thought that we would need to be vaccinated every single year, almost like a flu vaccination. Now, I do know that there is a lot of development that's going into trying to produce a flu vaccination that also contains a COVID vaccination within one injection for future use on an annual basis. And the Prime Minister did say that there's a lot of work that Israel is putting in to try to make sure that we have these long-term procurement agreements with pharmaceutical companies that will allow us to obtain those vaccines going forward each and every year. And he spoke a little bit about the cost of the vaccination, and he dismissed the fact that, you know, there's been a lot of criticism about the cost of the vaccination. So overall, what he also said, which I think was interesting, was that the reason why a company like Pfizer has entered into an agreement with Israel in order to get all this information, in return for which obviously Israel has been given a good supply of the vaccine, is because Israel has an infrastructure, medical system, which really supports the gathering of that information, good computerized health maintenance organizations who are able to very, very quickly implement all that's needed in order to collect the information and to monitor it and to provide that information to Pfizer. So he felt that, you know, Israel was at an advantage because of the fact that we have this very, very solid infrastructure, which has allowed the collection of the information. So those are the things that for me were quite interesting. Now he also addressed the issue of the under 16s. No trials were conducted on people under the age of 16. And we're now seeing that our teenage population is being quite badly impacted by those people who are being infected by the virus. And so now there's a lot more focus on whether the under 16s might be able to be vaccinated or not. At the moment, Israel is not vaccinating under 16s, and there doesn't seem to be any change on the horizon to that particular strategy. But I guess that the pharmaceutical companies are working on this because it would be in their interest to make sure that the other 16s get vaccinated too.
Mm, absolutely. President Biden has frozen arms and equipment sales to the Middle East, to Middle East countries. Oi, is this going to impact on Israel?
Well, nothing has been mentioned about freezing sales to Israel. And interestingly, all the articles that I've read talk about freezing the sale of those F-35s to the United Arab Emirates, and also freezing of some sales of arms and equipment to Saudi Arabia. Having said that, Antony Blinken, who's now sworn in, I think, as the new Secretary of State, said that the new Biden administration is very much supportive of the Abraham Accords, and we do know that the sale of those 35s, the stealth fighters to the United Arab Emirates kind of formed part of the normalization of relationships between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, and Prime Minister Netanyahu was somewhat criticized for having the audacity to agree to allow the United States to sell those planes to the United Arab Emirates because it could potentially dilute Israel's advantage, military advantage, in the region, in the event it was apparently agreed, at least by the Trump administration. And so it's interesting for me to understand to what extent the new Biden administration is obliged to respect agreements that were entered into by the previous administration. And while the new administration has been at pains to point out that what they're doing right now is just freezing things and taking a new look and a strategic overview of where the different powers are within the Middle East in particular, but also elsewhere around the world, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to stop the sales on a long-term basis, but at least they're pausing them for now in order just to take stock of the situation. I wonder whether they would be entitled to actually go against the agreements and not to fulfill them, if that's what they decide under the new strategic arrangement that they might assess for world powers. And obviously, the sale of U.S. arms and ammunition equipment to countries around the world is a potential game changer in terms of the balance of power in certain parts of the world. And so this is an interesting one. And I wonder, A, whether, you know, Israel may well suffer as a result of them deciding not to sell things to Israel moving forward. It's certainly a possibility. It doesn't seem to be mentioned in the press at the moment. But also, I just wonder whether the United Arab Emirates might turn around and say, well, our relationship with Israel that we've entered into on the basis of the purchase of these F-35s is now damaged because you didn't fulfill your side of the agreement. I mean, I'm not sure, to be honest. So we're just kind of watching and waiting to see what will happen. But it is certainly an interesting moment where things have just been paused, and it's not clear how it will pan out moving forward.
Right. And finally, actually, before I tell you, finally, Tzvi says, and I just want to read you what he says, that the Shemitah is about the land. The land rests, not the fruit. So there's a distinction between the fruit and the land, which is why they happen at different times. But
thank you. That's interesting.
The a controversy has broken out around the depiction of Rabbi Kanievsky on an Israeli satirical program on TV. What is tell us about this?
So, yeah, I just wanted your view on this as well, Howard, because I know you have a habit sometimes of being a little tongue-in-cheek in the way that you address things, and certainly I am. So I stand guilty as charged when being quite cynical and somewhat satirical in my view of the world. But there is this program in Israel called Eretz Nehederet. It's a satirical program. It really has the habit of taking people to pieces, says out loud in a kind of funny tongue-in-cheek way, people really leave. I mean, I think it's the truth being told, but trying to be funny to try and wrap it up as if though it's kind of comedy, but really so much of it is true. And last night there was a program on TV, Eretz Nehederet, where they for the first time depicted Haredi leader Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, as well as his grandson, Yanky Kanievsky. And immediately the Haredi community was up in arms saying that this is disrespectful and that Rabbi Kanievsky and the sages, Jewish sages, shouldn't be subject to these satirical comments and the type of atmosphere that this program generally presents. I know that, for example, in other countries around the world, satire is very much accepted and there are no limits. Everybody who chooses to be a public figure is potentially a target for these satirical programs. I think of Spitting Image, which is a British TV program, which really has the habit of taking the mickey out of people and really taking people to pieces. Saying, as I say, some of the truths, but saying it in a very kind of tongue-in-cheek way. Do you think that Rabbi Kanievsky should be off limits?
I definitely don't, actually, because I know I'm going to get a lot of pushback from this, but I really don't. If some, you know, we all I've got to say is Charlie Hebdo, and that should make and that should make sense. I think that if you don't like it, don't watch it. If it isn't for you, then don't make it for you. I think that nobody should be off limits if it's satire. You know, and yes, sometimes it's very, very painful. We've had a couple of issues, a couple of incidents here in South Africa where people have made very, very, I think in horrible taste, spoofs and things like that around community and around community leadership. And personally, I don't like it. And I didn't like it at all. I didn't share it. I didn't play it on air. I didn't write about it because it wasn't something that I wanted to be associated with or liked in any way. But does that mean it should be banned? It should be off limits? No. It just means I don't like it. I don't think it was in good taste. Some satire I do think is in good taste. That's just my choice. So the choice is to make it. The choice is for you to watch it. No, I think nobody should be off limits for anything like that. That's
yeah, I mean, I have the view that if you're going to put your head above the parapet and be a public figure in any form, whether it be in the religious community or in a political context or sport or whatever it is, then you are allowing yourself to become a public target.
Absolutely.
And while what you're doing may well have some value to it and you might feel that there is good things about it, obviously, inevitably in a public role, there will be people who disagree with you and will might have something to say about it.
Mm. Anthony Reich, unfortunately, we leave it on that sad note. Have a wonderful weekend, a Shabbat Shalom, and we will catch you tomorrow morning.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.